States against Knox. Mr. McGowan.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrew J. McGowan. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Anthony Knox. I intend to address the 101 disparity argument raised by both Mr. Knox and Mr. Davis, unless there are any questions about any of the other issues that Mr. Knox raised, Anthony Knox, that is. We believe that this case is controlled by this court's very recent opinion in Liddell. Under very similar facts, the court in Liddell held that after the career offender guidelines had been calculated under the 3553A factors and as a question of whether the sentencing guideline range is too large, the district court may consider the 100-to-1 crack powder disparity. The difference in Liddell in this case is that in these cases, the defendants raised the issue below. In Liddell, the issue was not raised. The court found that this was not plain error, but that it was error. The government's most recent 28J letter, which I received at about 5 o'clock last night, takes great issue with Liddell. I would suggest that, in fact, it is more appropriately raised.
If your reading of Liddell is correct, Liddell overruled United States against Harris, and our circuit rules say that panels can't overrule one another. Right? There is a way to do that. It's by a Rule 40 circulation. Liddell was not circulated, and therefore Liddell did not overrule Harris.
Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree that Liddell overrules Harris.
I don't say Liddell overruled Harris. I'm saying that your reading of Liddell is one that is inconsistent with Harris. Now, of course, we can reconcile Liddell and Harris, I think.
I believe that Liddell does.
If Harris applies to this case, I think you're in trouble.
I would agree. But I believe that Liddell does distinguish between
Well, but
Harris.
If your argument is that we agree we lose under Harris, we argue that we win under Liddell, then you're arguing that Liddell has overruled Harris.
Your Honor, I don't believe that I actually said that Harris controls in this case. My argument is that Liddell controls and that Liddell distinguishes between Harris and... It mentions Harris several times. It acknowledges the holding in Harris. It distinguishes between, evidently, this court's view, or at least in Liddell, this court's view that the Kimbrough 101 argument was based on the calculations of the career offender guideline.
Where does Liddell discuss Harris?
Liddell discusses Harris.
I've just typed the word in my search function here, and it does not come up.
I believe that Harris is cited at least three times in Liddell.
Well, it's entirely possible that there's some error here.
In fact, the part in Harris that specifically talks about Harris and the holding in Harris is right before the court talks about the more nuanced argument that Liddell makes, which was, while a district court cannot consider the crack powder in calculating the career offender guideline range, it can consider the disparity as a reason for issuing a below-guideline sentence. I'm afraid I don't know the page number on that. Anyway, I would like to address the government's 28J letter, which, for the most part, seems to be more appropriately raised in a petition for rehearing in Liddell. The government cited, in fact, its brief in Harris, which doesn't seem to fit the pertinent and significant authorities language in 28J. However, I disagree with the government's conclusion that the holding in Liddell is somehow dicta. The holding is simply that there was not plain error, but that there was error. And we believe that controls in this case.
What about the Clanton case?
Your Honor, my reading of the Clanton case is that it relies pretty much entirely on Harris. In fact, the more nuanced argument is in Harris.
Well, the Kimbrough case was addressing simply the guideline calculation Section 2, whatever it is, 2B1.1, or I can't recall the exact numbering, was not addressing the career offender enhancement.
I beg your pardon?
It was not Kimbrough did not address the career offender enhancement. That
absolutely
is,
not.
That is required by statute.
Right. I agree. But the question in Liddell that it addresses is, after the career offender guideline calculation has been made, what's the district court's discretion? And in fact, Harris acknowledges that 4B1.1, which is the career offender guideline, is no less the district court is able to deviate from that, give a non-guideline sentence, either above or below, based on the 3553A factors, or the district court's conclusion that a sentence within the guidelines is either too high or too low.
Can the district court disagree with congressional enactment?
I believe that the district court can disagree with the guidelines, and I believe that it's just one of the distinctions that's made.
With the guidelines, but the problem I have is that the career offender guideline doesn't depend on the 100-to-1 ratio. It depends on 994H, which is a statute, and it depends on the statutory maximum for the crime, which is a statute, but it doesn't depend on the 100-to-1 ratio in the guidelines. Now, I would understand the argument that career offender guideline is the greater of the things set by the statutory maximum and the things set by the underlying base offense level. So it's possible that somebody convicted of a crack offense would have the career offender guideline be higher for the crack offense than for the straight career offender calculation. And then you could easily see the Kimbrough argument. But if the only way the career offender guideline is being generated is as a result of two statutes, how does Kimbrough get into it?
I believe the problem is that a career offender guideline, no matter how it's calculated, no matter whether it's based on 841 calculations or as it is under the direction by the commission, that it becomes a guideline. Once it's established...
Yeah, it is a guideline. That's right. But it's not a guideline that in any way reflects the ratio between crack and powder cocaine.
Well...
It reflects only the statutory maximum of the crime.
One of the arguments that has been raised is that if you evaluate a career offender guideline based on powder cocaine as opposed to crack cocaine, you come out different, even though it's a very high guideline. But in this case, we have a further distinction in that the government established the offense essentially by changing a guns for money to a guns for drugs. Those are kinds of things that the district court, once a career offender calculation has been established, can use as a basis to go below the career offender guidelines, unless this court believes the career offender guidelines really are not advisory, in which case that's different than what Harris says.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. McGowan. Ms. Dunn.
May it please the court. Counsel, I represent Reginald Davis, and I would like to address, I concur with my co-counsel concerning the Kimbrough issue, but I would like to address my belief that the sentence imposed in this case on Mr. Davis was greater than necessary. At sentencing, Mr. Davis raised several arguments as to why a guideline sentence was not reasonable. In our view, the court either ignored or erroneously rejected the arguments. Basically, it's our view that the judge treated the guidelines in her analysis as mandatory, although time and time again she said she understood that they were advisory. I would draw your attention to the career offender enhancement that Mr. Davis got. It's my belief that it was treated as mandatory because the way Judge St. Eve analyzed it.
The probability that Judge St. Eve thinks this is mandatory is utterly minuscule. In addition to the fact that she knows the law, she also said several times on the record, I'm well aware that it's not.
Well, it may not be that she thinks they're mandatory, but she treated them as mandatory. And I would like to tell you how.
I thought your client got a below-guideline sentence.
He got 42 months below the guideline, and it was warranted.
So that's a non-guideline sentence.
And there you are.
Well, I understand, but it was warranted. Does that mean that his other issues should be excluded because he got 42 months based on mental illness and abuse during childhood? That's the problem I have with it. Because he got 42 months and it was clear it was based on his childhood and his mental illness, the analysis of whether or not he was properly placed in career offender was ignored. In fact, the judge didn't mention it, which I think it was a non-frivolous argument. I believe she needed to address it, and she did not. The career offender guideline unjustly condemned Mr. Davis. If you look through it, and I think we're allowed to do that under 3553A factors, and start with his prior convictions. You need two prior convictions when you're 18 and they are crimes of violence or possessions with intent.
And he had those.
He had two when he was barely 19. So these are factors a judge can consider.
Strikes me as worse. It shows he's into a life of violent crime early. It doesn't make things better.
It almost makes it better because it takes it outside the career offender if he's 18. So fortuitously, if he had been 18, he would not have been a career offender. And my point is the courts require that you look at his age. And she did not talk about his age, the judge. She did not consult about his age. Also, the other issue that was ignored completely about career offender, which I think cases have taken into account and reduced drastically, if you review the case law, drastic reductions based on the type of crime it was, the actual amount of drugs distributed. In his prior cases, he delivered less than a gram. Less than a gram. And also, you look at the time he was in prison. The total time he was in prison for his cases that elevated him to career offender status was 22 months. Now he was looking at about 22 years, and he got like 18 and a half based on mental illness.
The prior convictions were state court convictions?
They were state court.
And that's a more typical drug trafficking state sentence, is it not?
It
so
is.
This would be true of most career offenders who come into court with two predicate state court drug offenses.
They get
short periods of time in prison.
But it would be a very low sentence in federal court with a tenth of a gram.
But it's not at all uncommon in the state system to get sentences of 2 to 4 years for first and second offense drug trafficking.
Yeah, I think you get sentenced what the statute drives, but yes, I mean, there's a lot of drug cases that grow through the state courts.
It's actually one of the reasons Congress enacted this system, right? The perception was that state courts were slapping people on the wrists, but after that's happened twice and you don't learn, a ton of bricks is going to fall on your head. The argument that because state courts are slapping on the wrists, a ton of bricks should not fall on the defendant's head is just amounts to disagreement with the federal statute.
Well, I think it's beyond that. I think it's you look at the nature and the history of the individual, and it's fair to say that to consider that as proper, that it was a small amount, regardless of the state court system.
He wasn't a small amount of street-level dealing, a recidivist pattern.
And a recidivist pattern based on his childhood and his mental illness. And the judge excluded analysis under the career offender. And I think because of his career offender behind-the-scene issues, a larger departure was warranted. And briefly, before I run out of time, there was another issue that I thought should be considered that was not considered or considered improperly, and another reason why I think the guidelines were considered or treated mandatorily by the judge. The 5K1 that was in place through a plea agreement, it was rejected because Mr. Davis was not allowed to argue, according to the government, his mental illness. Thank you.
Mr. Dyes.
May it please the court, Bill Tice for Armin Knox. The government has agreed that Armin Knox's case should be remanded, so unless the court has some questions about Mr. Armin Knox's case, I'll sit down.
I do have a question about that. Was there a Kimbrough-type argument made about the crack powder disparity either in the district court or here as to your client?
There was not, and that's why the government suggests, and we can't disagree, that the Taylor case would be the sort of remand that would be available.
Well, no, Taylor sets forth procedures for plain error review.
Right.
It doesn't speak to the situation that I just inquired about, which is waiver. The argument was forfeited in the district court, or at least you're telling me that it was, and it wasn't raised here by you. The only argument that was raised here had to do with the guidelines amendment and the Sentencing Commission's imposition of retroactive applicability of the guidelines amendment, and that issue is addressed procedurally in the ordinary course, first to the district court by way of a motion under 3582 and not as an appellate issue on direct appeal. There isn't any basis for us to remand for that motion to be made. We don't have such a motion before us yet. It's made in the first instance to the district court.
I don't believe we've waived the argument in this court. We've asked for the case to be remanded because
you haven't invoked the Kimbrough issue, the disparity between crack and powder cocaine as a discretionary consideration, as the Kimbrough case held. You've invoked just the sentencing guideline amendment, which is a different sort of a thing.
Regrettably, Your Honor, I can't agree with that. I think that it's close enough for purposes of what should be done. And under Taylor, what the court would do would be to remand it to the district judge and let the district judge give an indication.
Only if the argument was forfeited and we're reviewing under plain error. And then there's a Taylor remand, which corresponds to the Palladino remand, post-Booker, et cetera. It set forth the methodology for determining plain error review and what happens in the district court on a limited remand. It doesn't address waiver when the argument wasn't raised.
I can't agree that we waived, but I don't want to quibble with the court. I take it the court is not saying that Mr. Armin Knox is precluded from making a motion in the district court under the retroactivity provision.
That could have been made any time after, I think it was March 1st of this year.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Fullerton.
Good morning. May it please the court. As the court made clear in Clanton and Harris, while the sentencing guidelines are advisory for district court judges, congressional legislation is not, and therefore when a sentence is calculated pursuant to the career offender guidelines, which are driven by statutory maxima set by Congress in Section 841, it is not proper for the district court to deviate from the guidelines based on the disagreement with the crack powder disparity, the 100-to-1 disparity that was the subject of Kimbrough. Clanton and Harris are very clear on that. Liddell is, we believe, impossible to reconcile with Clanton and Harris, and we submit that Liddell was essentially wrongly decided.
Or at least that there was language in Liddell with which you don't agree.
Was not necessary to the outcome in that case.
Conviction and sentence were affirmed in Liddell. I assume you won't be filing a petition for rehearing.
No, Your Honor. But the 100-to-1 disparity that is the subject of Kimbrough doesn't play a role in the career offender sentencing unless, as Judge Easterbrook pointed out, there is an alternative to the 4B1.1 where the drug quantity calculation results in a higher sentence than the career offender guideline. In that case, which was an instance in one of the defendants in the Clanton case, I believe, at a 2D1.1 sentence higher than the career offender guideline, then the Kimbrough issue is pertinent. But where the 4B1.1 sentence, the career offender range, is not the product of the 100-to-1 disparity, the district court should not, may not, consider the 100-to-1 disparity in going below that guideline range. Now, here...
Well, I agree. It can still consider any appropriate reason for giving a non-guideline sentence.
Absolutely, Judge. And here the district court appropriately did treat...
Right. So your argument, then, is... that when the range doesn't depend on the 100-to-1 ratio, that ratio is not appropriate. It would be no more appropriate for departure than the fact that a particular defendant was said to be, a multiple amputee when, in fact, he had all four limbs.
That's correct. And it would no more appropriate than would a disagreement with the stiffness of penalties under, say, the fraud guideline. That the guideline didn't affect the sentence, and it would be inappropriate for the district court to deviate or to vary downward based on disagreement with a guideline that had no effect in producing the sentence. So we think that as for Anthony Knox and Reginald Davis, the district court's the sentences ought to be affirmed. There's no need for a Kimbrough remand or Taylor remand, and the sentences are appropriate. As far as Army and Knox goes, it raises the...
Are you waiving waiver?
Well, we may have, Judge, because we didn't raise that issue in our brief. This is the first I've thought about it, so I'm not prepared now to concede that we've waived waiver, but that may have been. That may have been the case.
What's the Department of Justice's position on whether the guidelines amendment is appropriately raised as an issue on direct appeal and entitlement to remand for that, as opposed to necessitating a motion in the district court in the first instance?
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor.
In other cases, we've heard
the other cases,
the latter,
right,
and your colleagues.
And it's by far the more normal course to have these things brought up in the district court first on the 3582 motion. But in this case, I don't know the answer to your question, Your Honor. So
what are you saying we should do with Armian?
Well, Armian is, as we pointed out in the brief, he is his sentence was not the product of the career offender guideline. It was the product of a 2D1.1 guideline that the district court calculated without reference to Kimbrough.
And he's eligible for the two levels.
He would be eligible for the 3582 reduction of two levels.
But your agreement was to send it back for total resentencing. Right.
Well, on the Taylor type of remand, but we may have...
No, the Taylor remand is completely different from a remand for resentencing. Your brief, I thought, like Judge Tinder, said that we should remand for resentencing. Not that we should ask the district court per Taylor what its current views were.
Judge, I misspoke.
Which of these things is it the position of the United States that we should do?
For Army Knox, our position is that he ought to be resentenced pursuant to the in the post-Kimbrough world. We may have waived the waiver that Judge Sykes raised with regard to the proper procedure for him to have raised this issue, but it's our position he is entitled to the reduction, and whether he's entitled to the reduction. It's our position, Judge. Now, with regard to Reginald Davis and his argument that the district court improperly considered the career offender guideline to be mandatory, I think it's pretty clear that Judge St. Eve did not consider the guideline to be mandatory. She said that it was not multiple times, and she, of course, treated the guideline as advisory in going below the career offender guideline range. The fact is that the district court didn't believe that the arguments raised by Reginald Davis warranted any further departure than the 42 months, and that was not an abuse of her discretion. Reginald Davis had, in the pre-sentence investigation report, at least 16 criminal history points without reference to the career offender guideline. He was in Category 6 of the criminal history, Category 6 of criminal history without just on sheer points alone. So he had an extensive criminal history that had gone on from an early age. I believe his first conviction was at age 12. That didn't count for these calculations, but he was a man who has had an extensive, long-time criminal history that the district court, in her discretion, did not believe warranted any more departure than she gave him. That was not clearly not an abuse of discretion, and we would ask that that sentence be affirmed. So unless there are any more questions from the court, we just ask that affirm the sentences of Anthony Knox and Reginald Davis. With regard to Armian Knox, we'd ask that, consistent with our brief, ask that he be remanded for resentencing. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Domph, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and the assistance to both your client and the court. The case is taken under advisement.